Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
8 minutes past six on this Wednesday evening. The Money Show proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Awards for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show on this Wednesday evening. Lots of politics at the moment. We won't focus too much on that, although it does have a direct impact, of course, on your money ultimately because of the huge uncertainties and implications and the latest spat of ANC infighting, responding to Tito Mboweni's perfectly logical argument, challenging members of the ANC to think and say, why is it that you want the Reserve Bank nationalized? Has anybody actually asked the question? Yes, the elective conference voted to nationalize the Reserve Bank, but has anybody actually considered why? Why? Just tell me why. And now he's in trouble for asking a question on policy. It's not causing policy confusion. He's trying to get policy clarity. He's trying to get sensible policy in place. And the ANC is now closing ranks on him. It's an astonishing place. I mean, I've been away from social media mostly, sort of dipping in from time to time for a month. And it's been a peaceful month. What a good month it's been, mostly for you. But, you know, from my perspective, just getting out of the noise. Oh, my word, what a joy it was. But we're back in the noise. We're back in the hot seat. And we've got some fabulous guests for you this evening. Standing by, John Manyike, the head of financial education at Old Mutual, to warn you about the shock that's coming your way. When it comes to education costs, private or public education is going to cost you a fortune between now, if your kids have gone to school for the first time this week or in whatever year they're in, up until they finally matriculate. And if they do go to university and you're going to stump up those costs, what is this going to cost you over the next 10, 12, 15 years of your life? And then November retail sales were pretty good. We'll catch up with Stephen van Koller, chief executive at EOH, about corruption. He's written a really interesting piece today on Daily Maverick, all about what he's learned about corruption. Arthur Goldstuck on tech and our business unusual feature. Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, on that real controversy where ShopRite was found in breach of and making reckless loans. And then cashless South Africa. Wouldn't that be a joy? No more cash in transit vehicles on the roads. It would be a far more peaceful place. ATMs wouldn't be necessary anymore. We wouldn't have to be blowing up ATMs in order to get access to cash. If we could all do it with the help of an app, is it 1, 2, 5, or 100 years away? I wonder. The guys behind Ukeshe tonight on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
First the good news and then on to the reality, because children go back to school this week and the fees you pay today are the lowest they're ever going to be. So enjoy this year's fees. And I know you feel as if you've had somebody dip their whole fist into your back pocket, take out your wallet, scan all of your credit cards, take all your apps off your phone and suck all the cash out of those and take every last cent that you've got after paying for books and the school materials and uniforms and all of the extras, plus the fees. Of course, school is a very, very expensive operation. So if you're worried about how you're going to make it through this year, how on earth are you going to cope into the future? John Manyike has been crunching some numbers. He's the head of financial education at Old Mutual. And that is the reality, John. I mean, this year's education bill is the smallest it's ever going to be, because next year it goes up, the year after that it goes up, and goes up in perpetuity.
Absolutely. Good evening to you, Bruce. I don't think a lot of parents have actually sat down to calculate the cost, you know, the cost of education. I mean, when our actuaries gave us these projections, I mean, I was really shaking in disbelief. So for parents who are taking their children to a public school, to public primary or high school, including a three-year university degree, they can expect to pay up to 1.6 million rand during the academic lifespan of their children. But then for those parents who prefer to take their children to private school, the figure doubles to 3.7 million rand. I mean, I looked at the number there. I mean, this is also taking into account that we're working on an education cost inflation of 9% year on year. In 2035, a university degree, just as a three-year university degree, you can expect to pay just over 750,000. And these are very conservative numbers that we're talking about.
What is pushing up? I mean, why do the actuaries use 9% as an education inflation number? Education has got, you know, I understand in medical inflation, there's research and there's technology and there's new science that improves the health of patients. And so I understand that, you know, medical inflation can go into double digits. I don't understand why education inflation is at 9%. What makes it so high?
Yeah, so remember, you need to take into account, you know, all the fees that are involved in taking a child to school. I mean, your school fees, you're talking transport to actually take your child to school, it's stationary, you know, you consider all those costs. And you realize that these costs are not constant. I mean, they change, you know, on an annual basis. I mean, if you take that inflation in particular, then you'll find out that actually the costs are actually much higher than our CPI.
And you wonder whether we're getting bang for our buck also, because, I mean, there's so much window dressing when it comes to matric results, and we've just gone through the charade, not the charade, did I call it a charade, through the process over the last week or two, you know, of record numbers of passes, and, you know, the Free State Education Department, you know, the Free State kids are the brightest in the country, look at the pass rate there. We're paying so much money and not necessarily getting great education outcomes. I'm off to Davos and the World Economic Forum next week. I mean, they keep publishing terrible statistics about the education outcomes in South Africa. And if you go through a public schooling system, the odds of, you know, emerging with a valuable piece of paper at the end of it are considerably lower than the kids who are going through a private system.
Yeah, look, I think there's no doubt that the you know, our education system does need some overhaul. I mean, and that's why you're seeing the Department of Basic Education starting to look at other things. I mean, I know there's been a debate about this grade 9 story, but I think people need to understand where the department is coming from. The reality is, let's look at what the future careers are going to be looking like. I mean, things like artificial intelligence, environmental changes, these things are giving rise to new careers. Now, if the quality of labor is not going to improve over the next 10, 15 years, our situation could actually get worse. We are sitting with more than 50% of our youth that are unemployed. But again, you have to really look at what do they have to offer in the job market. I mean, so that's why it's important that we start looking at that. You know, the fourth industrial revolution is unavoidable. So therefore, we need to then start preparing our children. Preparing children includes saving for their future education, because when they get to that point where they pass a matric, how do you enable that child as a parent to further their studies in there? Because I can assure you there are a lot of learners who have great potential, but unfortunately are unable to pursue their careers because of financial limitations.
No, absolutely. I mean, and all parents start out with this rosy-eyed idea that, you know, when my child is born, or even, oh, we've conceived, we should start saving for this nameless child and putting money away. And it all seems like a very good idea until the reality of the cost of having kids hits. And then not very few people are actually able to save.
No, that's very true. In fact, the Old Mutual Savings and Investment Monitor says about 55% of urban South African parents are actually not saving for their children's education at all. Now, I'm sure you've heard the cliche that if you are failing to plan, then you are planning to fail. I mean, I think that there's a lot of truth in that statement, because we cannot expect things to be different unless we're going to be doing something different. Yes, we have to appreciate the fact that there are other realities, such as levels of over-indebtedness that we're dealing with. But, I mean, this is where we all need to speak to a financial advisor. How do we find the right balance between having to service that debt, but at the same time finding the right savings instrument in order to, to help our children prepare for the future.
John, thank you. John Manyike is the head of financial education at Old Mutual, on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. And it is so interesting. And finally, we're beginning to see a little level of collaboration, a little level of collaboration between public and private sectors. Now, the Curo partnership that the government and Curo getting a partnership between private schools and government, governments are beginning to realize that it can't do it all itself. And so it's in discussions with Curo about getting Curo to take some kids who are falling outside of the school's net, I think it's in Gauteng, and to take these kids into the Curo environment. Now, you run into a range of really interesting possibilities when you go down that path. You start giving kids a really good opportunity to learn really well. Does Curo change its model and go from 25 kids on average in a class to 40 kids in order to accommodate at a lower price government-educated kids? Or, as Chris van der Merwe, the founder of Curo, he's now out of the business, but as he once said to me, he wanted to go and do a deal with government where he said he could build government schools to government specs for less than government was doing, and he could then educate kids at the same price that government was educating them at, make a profit, and kids get better education outcomes. Now, government wouldn't want to go down that path because it would make the rest of its education system seem to be as blatantly poor as it is. But boy, we've got to think differently about education, because you look at the numbers that Old Mutual has published today, and in today's money, a kid going into grade R in a private school system in today's money is going to cost 3.6 million rand by the time they finish a third year at university. And if they decide to go further or decide that they need to get a master's and they rely on the bank of mum and dad, that number is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you go through the public system at 1.6 million rand, it's nuts. It's a vast amount of money. And who are you to say no to a bright child who wants a bright future? So then you've got your job, your spouse has got their job, and then you must start having two and three jobs, finding alternative ways to raise the money to educate your kids. Because also the outcomes that the kids are getting in the public school system are diabolical. There's plenty of data to prove that as well. Scary story. Sorry to make that the most brutal story of the year so far, and we've only just begun.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Chris Stewart, do we care about the Russian government sort of stepping aside, Vladimir Putin looking to rejig his constitution and do all kinds of things? I mean, it's still very, very uncertain, but Dmitry Medvedev stepping down as prime minister, creating space for the president, Vladimir Putin, to do whatever Vladimir Putin wants to do, it would seem. Do markets care?
Yeah, when Vladimir Putin does anything, I think one should stand up and take note. Bruce, I haven't got enough detail to provide a particularly pithy comment on it, but certainly something to watch. And if there is something sinister afoot, then the markets will take concern, yeah.
Well, markets today were very positive about the retail sales numbers coming through from November. Now, I know you're not a big fan of the huge delay in retail sales numbers because they now are 3 months old, but they do tell us an interesting story about what consumer demand was like in November, and Black Friday and a small thing called the Rugby World Cup seem to have had a huge impact on our capacity to spend.
Yeah, Bruce, I mean, you know, Black Friday always creates some degree of distortion, and although Black Friday was in November 2019 and in November 2018, one could therefore argue that the base effect is there, therefore we shouldn't be too worried about it. However, Black Friday did come through quite a lot later in November of 2019 than it did in November of 2018. I think November 2018, quite a lot of people hadn't been paid by the time Black Friday came along, and therefore there was lots of bargains out there that people couldn't buy because they didn't have any money, those who weren't obviously spending on credit, whereas Black Friday was much later in the month in 2019, and as a result of that, that may have boosted the sales artificially, if you like. And equally well, Black Friday, unfortunately, does tend to bring forward December sales into November, but at much lower margin for the retailers, which may mean that although the sales number looks okay, what happens on the margin line for the retailers? We've got most of the retailers starting to bring through their trading updates. We saw Truworths coming through just before the close today. We'll see the balance of the retailers over the next couple of weeks. And I'm not particularly holding my breath for great numbers out of it.
No, I mean, just far too many people walking around the shops sort of looking through the windows rather than going into the shops, and certainly not coming out carrying branded plastic bags. I mean, there was a lot more window shopping than possibly ever before last December. There didn't seem to be much activity at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always loath to draw too many anecdotes, particularly as I'm not
you don't hang around the shops.
Regular attendee of shopping malls, but you know, the limited experience I had with some last minute panic Christmas shopping is, yeah, there was parking, things were pretty quiet in the shops, and didn't look as though there was a bumper amount of spending going on. Time, you know, we will find out relatively soon. But I would be quite surprised if we saw bullish trading updates coming out of pretty much any of the retailers, Bruce.
I would agree. And I saw one headline today suggesting, Black Friday may have prevented South Africa from going into recession in the final quarter. I don't know how that's even possible. Do you believe we did see a full-blown recession last year?
No, I mean, maybe we didn't go into a technical recession, but I'm not sure if that's that relevant.
We like to give labels to things.
We do like to give labels to things. The point is, the economy is in a tough space. You know, as I say, you saw a trading update out of Truworths just before the close today. There was evidence of a further slowdown. You know, we had seen their retail sales for the first 4 months of the second half of last year, being the first half of their financial year. And the last 2 months indicated a fairly pronounced slowdown, particularly in the UK, as their struggling office brand substantially rationalized their store footprint. So you saw a lot of store closures, and with the store closures taking place, that had a big impact on the offshore sales component of Truworths. But you also saw the domestic sales, and particularly the domestic cash sales, over the last 2 months of last calendar year coming through lower than they had for the prior four-month period. So it does look as though it's pretty tough out there. Whether you call it a recession or not, it's tough. It's likely to remain tough. Don't think we're going to get, to preempt the next question, any relief in terms of rates from the South African
Reserve Bank. We get an announcement tomorrow.
Yeah. I think they will choose to err on the side of conservatism, despite the fact that we've got record high real interest rates in South Africa. Inflation's behaving particularly well. There's no doubt in my mind the South African Reserve Bank will have to revise down further its GDP growth forecasts for 2020. Globally, you're seeing more evidence of the US are probably on hold, but you're seeing more evidence of the likelihood of further monetary accommodation in the UK. You saw a benign inflation number coming out in the UK today. More and more pundits starting to expect rate cuts there. There's going to be more monetary accommodation in Europe. All the signs are that we should be cutting, but there's a couple of risk events coming up that are probably going to lead the SARB to err on the side of conservatism.
I spent a day or two in the UK and on my holidays and went looking for South African connected retailers just to get a sense of it. And the one that I saw that stood out with its 70% discounts after Christmas was New Look. This is Brait's retailer that they bought and then wrote down 35 billion rands worth of it. The emptiest shop in the entire shopping mall in Manchester at the Trafford Centre, which is owned by what used to be Liberty International, Intu Properties. It was empty, 70% off, and they couldn't sell the stuff in the shops. The local brands, the Sports Directs of the world and everything else humming, and people going out and buying one-third price trainers and all sorts of things. New Look had nobody in the shops. It's really interesting when you start looking for South African companies operating internationally and you realize just how much of a dwang they're in.
Yeah, you don't have to look too far. There's a couple of local retailers that one could draw a very similar parallel to that at the moment, and certainly I didn't see too many people storming through Edcon branches over the Christmas period either, Bruce.
Yeah, no, and that's a big problem. I mean, Grant Patterson's got a big problem on his hands there because he's trying to drive a turnaround in that one. And then the Dion Wyatt disaster, 35 stores closing, 1,500 jobs going to go. I mean, it's a really indicative, not only of changing shopping patterns, that's the spin, but don't tell me that Takealot's absorbing every single Dion Wyatt customer 5 years ago. They're simply not. People just aren't buying as much electrical stuff as they used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's pressure on disposable income and it's reflecting on non-discretionary purchases. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, looking ahead this year, it's quite difficult to paint a particularly rosy picture that this is the bottom. I mean, at least the share prices are a lot lower than they have been. The earnings multiples look more palatable. The dividend yields are starting to look quite attractive. The earnings numbers probably still are going to come down for the year ahead as the reality of another very, very tough year starts to sink in. When do you call the bottom on these stocks and start buying them? I'd rather see some sort of evidence of a turnaround on the ground before I got too excited, Bruce.
And if the Reserve Bank cuts rates tomorrow?
25 basis points symbolically. It's going to help in reality.
Another 25, two May meetings from today. So by May, June, we get another 25. That's 50.
Yeah, and so we start to gradually turn, Bruce.
But it's not going to happen that way.
It's unlikely to happen. It's unlikely to start tomorrow. I think we've got to get through the budget. I think we've got to get through the
ratings announcements.
Probably inevitable Moody's ratings downgrade to sub-investment grade. We've got to see what impact that has both on the currency and the bond market. Many, many arguments to say that certainly the bond market is more than fully discounting the downgrade to sub-investment grade. Currency market maybe a little bit less so. But I think policymakers, given their conservative slant in this country, are going to want to see those events in the rearview mirror before they open the taps on some sort of monetary accommodation, Bruce.
Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management, thank you very much indeed.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. 702 Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Out of practice, it would seem. Yes. Sorry about that. It's 21 minutes to 7. Butler standing by with the sport. But, coming up on The Money Show this evening, we've got Stephen Fancola. He's the chief executive at EOH. It was a company that for years, 2011, 12, 13, 14, was either the best or second best performing share on the JSE every year. Massively acquisitive company. Growing so fast, they could barely see through the dust that they were creating. And it just created an environment where there could be huge opportunity for corruption, and some of the businesses in which they invested were corrupt. Or maybe the people in the businesses were corrupt. Anyway, Stephen Fancola took over as CEO, I think just over 2 years ago, and has had a huge learning about corruption over that time, and has shared his thoughts in a very well thought out piece that he posted on Daily Maverick today. So I'll talk to him in a couple of minutes' time. On the next Money Show, the Independent Reserve Bank. Know that? Independent Reserve Bank. It's Monetary Policy Committee's decision on interest rates. We'll talk about that. Isa Mhlanga will talk to us about that decision and what the outlook is for interest rates. And then, of course, being a Thursday, we've got Warren Ingram, and we'll reflect with him, of course, on what lies ahead. And we've got Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator with Small Business. All of that is coming up on the next edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
Well, if you're a good and pure and driven person, you won't know what corruption is. But all of us have learned a lot more about corruption and how it very, very nearly has broken our country. We know a lot more about it today than we did 2 years ago, largely thanks to the efforts of the Zondo Commission. It's been a huge eye-opener. It's not been limited, though, to the public sector. There have been some scary private sector examples as well. Amongst them, senior auditors at KPMG aiding and abetting the theft of poor people's money from VBS Mutual Bank, the biggest bank robbery in South African history. Steinhoff, it could still collapse as a result of the fraudulent accounting practices. And EOH, once a market darling, as I was telling you a moment ago, finding itself at the center of a series of corruption scandals. Interesting piece today from Stephen Fancola, the chief executive at EOH, tasked with the cleanup. And Stephen Fancola, I mean, when you took on the job, you knew you were going like Daniel into the lion's den, to invoke a biblical story. But did you anticipate that it would be nearly as fraught, nearly as widespread, nearly as complex and insidious as it's turned out to be?
Hi, Bruce. When I first went there, I already thought I was going to do a corporate restructuring, reordering, like I'd done many times before, and just working out how to put the company back on a profitable basis. I'd done some questions and had a look at some reports around some of the noise that was in the newspaper at the time, but I certainly didn't realize that it was corrupt and there were a lot of issues that I was going to have to sort out. And I think this is why I penned the article, because if I'd known all this before I went in there, there were some glaring signs that should really have alerted me.
I mean, it's so interesting. For somebody who worked as the CEO of an investment bank for as long as you did in banking and deal making, I mean, you would have come across more than your own fair share of crooks over that time and shysters and people trying to get one over you in order to get money out of you. But going into a business like that, should its managers have been more cognizant
of what you then uncovered to be a fairly obvious fraud later?
So what's really interesting is I think we totally underestimate what a great learning place a bank is. I spent 20 years in banking. I just expected that this is how businesses got run. Also, when you're dealing in corporate investment banking, you tend to only deal with the real top companies. And you don't really look further down and realize that, when I went in there, I just expected there to be a risk department or a compliance department. There was one person for 11,000 people. It was a bit of a surprise. When I asked for, can you give me the last 6 months EXCO tax in minutes so I can go through them, they didn't exist. And it was just stuff I expected because that's what you do, And I think that was really the wake-up call for me.
I mean, and it's that boring stuff. I mean, it's the boring stuff of compliance, which, I mean, it's the biggest department in most banks nowadays. I mean, compliance departments in banks 5 years ago employed 20 people. Now they employ 200 or 400 or more. So when it comes to this sort of limited idea of limited governance and compliance, do you think it was by default or design? I mean, was EOH set up with very few corporate governance and compliance structures to aid and abet corruption, or did they simply not do it and the chancers saw an opportunity by virtue of the fact that that stuff didn't exist to act corruptly?
Yeah, I think, Bruce, it was really, this business grew very fast. And when you're in a small entrepreneurial business, you just don't have enough money to have all fancy systems, but when it's small, as an owner, you know what's going on everywhere. When it gets big, you don't, and this is where you need to put the systems in place. And I think what happened here is, as these problems start emerging, you don't really want to uncover it because you're too scared to, what you find. But if you have a look at us here, people are corrupt, not businesses, and so even if you put in the best systems, if you don't have great people, they're going to find a way. But at least the systems help you manage it early, and it doesn't become part of the way a business runs. And this is what's so important about, King Code and things. And if you list it, I think you've got an obligation to make sure these things are there.
I mean, and also the issue of board independence, people sort of go, oh God, it's so dull, this compliance thing, and board independence, and you can't be independent after so long, and you've got to have so many independent directors, and you can't be independent if you were previously an executive for a certain period of time, and people get very frustrated by it. But without an independent board and without a board challenging executive management and executive directors, there's no way you're going to get things like governance and compliance right, because everybody is in the same boat, rowing in the same direction, and nobody wants to rock that boat. So the importance of board independence comes through so very, very strongly in the EOH and many other stories too.
I can't agree with you more. I've also always sort of thought, we do all these things and it's, part of just a process that you ask to go through. But when you get on the other side and you see why there were failures, this whole King Code, board independence, people not being there for too long, getting the different skills on the board, I think is massively important when you're investing pensioners' money. And I think it should be, I personally think that any asset manager who is investing a pensioner's money should not be allowed to invest in a company that is not King Code compliant, and they should do due diligence on that.
Another banker who's retired now once said to me, any company that does acquisitions at a rapid rate, and I think at the time he was referring to Steinhoff, but I mean, he could just as easily have been referring to EOH. Watch those guys, because there's no time to change the culture. There's no time to really inculcate a new culture. And also, I mean, so many of these corruption stories, and we've seen it, and from the earliest days of the Gupta scandals, the structures of setting up middlemen to do the jobs of executives, setting up middlemen to channel money. I mean, if there is ever a middleman involved in a deal that could be done between two people directly, you've got to be very, very cognizant that somebody is up to no good, I guess. And that's one of the big learnings from EOH, because the middlemen were very, very active.
Yes, it's twofold. In some countries, you need a middleman, but you need to deal with that middleman properly. There needs to be a proper onboarding, so you know who they are, what they are. You then, it can't be friends and family, which, you know, in some cases that's what we had, and there wasn't a proper process. And then secondly, you need to make sure that they subscribe to your code of ethics, and they need to warrant that so that, you know, there's some comeback if you, you know, something goes wrong. In our case, we didn't have any of that. We didn't have any agreements. We were just using people to make sure that we won certain contracts. And you don't know once you paid them their money what they've actually done with it and, you know, where it's gone. And that's really what goes wrong.
I mean, if you were ever to take on another executive job, I mean, I guess these would be the check. You'd have a new checklist. You'd take off your investment banking checklist and go into your CEO of a corruption, that was a company that was fraught with corruption, hat, and put that on next time. Because, I mean, it must have been a hugely eye-opening exercise.
No, absolutely. You know, it's often, you know, I'm a glass half full, you know, kind of guy, so you expect everyone to sort of have the same view and same ethics as you, but what I've learned is that it's not, and there are actually people out there who manage their processes to actually make money, you know, steal money, and they'll do it and they won't feel bad about it. And so now, I mean, if I had to be an executive at a, you know, different job at some point, there's definitely a checklist of things, almost like an investor, that I'm definitely going to go through. And if some of them aren't there, they have to be red flags. Yes, you can go and sort them out, but you really need to go in with your eyes very, very wide open.
Stephen Fonkola, thank you. He is the chief executive of EOH, still standing 2 years after taking over that job and discovering and uncovering a vast network of corruption.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, those retail sales numbers that came out earlier today did show a very much better November than was anticipated. It was a nice jump. Mike Schuster, there were a couple of really good reasons for it, that there was just a lot more money spent in November. Not necessarily more money in the economy, just more money being spent.
Yes, there was more money. We saw the Black Friday numbers from Bank South Africa, which showed some categories up 36%. Obviously, this wasn't deflated. But the whole picture was that Cyber Monday and Black Friday certainly were very, very successful in drawing in the crowds. And that meant it was a great marketing exercise. It certainly helped the November data. But as we also know, one has to seasonally adjust things. And over time, the seasonal adjustment, I think, will show us that, you know, this November isn't that great necessarily, because very simply it's probably taking away from December because the Black Friday phenomena is just growing. I mean, it's probably the biggest buying spree, weekend buying spree in the economy now, and that wasn't around 4 or 5 years ago.
But the fact that it all happens in November means it doesn't happen in December. It means that there's probably less on sale in January. So we simply get a sales boost earlier on in the year, and we don't necessarily get a sustainable sort of retail sector as a result. So when you look at the state of the economy and the fact that we went into load shedding again toward the end of last year, do you think this economy broke even last year? Do you think that we actually went below zero growth? Because some of the forecasts in early January were for 0.3% for the year. And it one wonders whether or not we even made that very, very paltry target.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, it all depends on the fourth quarter now. And the fourth quarter data is not going to be moonshine and roses. It's probably touch and go whether we declined again, in which case we will be in a technical recession, Bruce. But very simply put, I think we are looking at less than 0.5% and probably very close to 0% growth for last year. I hope we don't go negative. But there's no guarantee of that either. But we have, we have had some bright spots, and when things look a little bit positive, then the consumer does come back. That we have seen.
Yeah, but I mean, 1,500 jobs at Dion Wired. A story on MoneyWeb this evening. It was quoting sources saying 20% of staff at Telkom could go. It could affect 3,000 people at Telkom. We know so many companies are cutting back and cutting back quite severely. It feels very hard to be a 2020 optimist, I'm afraid, right now.
No, absolutely. I mean, everybody's cutting their growth forecasts. And as you talk to other economists, you get the feeling that even the 0.9% that the World Bank came out might be an optimistic growth target at the moment. And it obviously depends on various factors. But if you get the sort of load shedding that we had in December and it pops up for a few weeks again, whatever quarter that happens, it will be very, very negative and will bring the economy back down with a thump. And that's where we are, unfortunately. And then we're also going to see likely tax rises, spending decreases from government. All of those things are not positive for our growth, but are probably needed because we've lived beyond our means and we have to make a plan to bring down the deficit or we'll continuously get downgraded.
My thanks to Mike Schussler. It's a somber message, but it's a critical message. It's something we all need to absorb and adapt to, because the brutal reality is we've been spending like there's no consequence, and the consequences, unfortunately, now are coming home.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Award for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's Africa Nacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. Story breaking on Business Live this evening. The inimitable Carol Payton has been writing about SAA, and she's very well connected when it comes to the public sector and particularly SAA. She's done some cracking stories on SAA in recent months, and she's warning tonight that SAA could suspend flights by the weekend if the promised 2 billion rand that National Treasury said SAA would get when it went into business rescue doesn't come through. And lenders came through with their 2 billion, but the Treasury needs to sell assets to fund its side of the deal. There's long gone are the days when National Treasury can just make money available and say, sure, you need 2 billion rand, have a bailout, have a bailout, have a bailout. Now there's a real thing. I mean, if you want to buy a new car and you own some Kruger Rands, you need to sell some Kruger Rands in order to buy the car, for example. And South Africa has run out of Kruger Rands. And what Carol Payton writes this evening is SAA again in a perilous state after the 2 billion rand it was promised by the National Treasury to fund the business rescue process has not materialized. And without this funding, SAA could be forced to suspend flights by January the 19th and could go into liquidation, which involves selling the airline's assets to pay creditors. It's a deadly serious warning, and I've got no doubt that the money is going to come through. I think it will materialize, because the last thing Tito Mboweni wants to take to Davos, because he's going to be leading the South African delegation next week in Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, is to have to answer yet more embarrassing questions about state failure. And SAA hitting the wall would be a state failure. The state has been in charge of that airline and it has failed to manage it properly, or certainly it's failed to appoint the right people to manage it properly, and the place has been pillaged. And as a result of that, SAA has had countless bailouts. I mean, I've lost track, and I'm sure you have as well. But 2 billion rand to keep it going under business rescue practitioner. And a business rescue practitioner was saying before Christmas, there is a viable business. It can be rescued. It needs to be restructured. It needs to be changed. But if the money that was promised doesn't come through, SAA could be gone. Could be tickets. Ha ha. By the weekend.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
It's a really tough start to the year, and it's a really grim start to the year. But the world of fast fashion, and if you're something of a fashionista, could I caution you against your bad habits? Because the world of fast fashion is causing havoc for the environment. There are new stats from the United Nations that suggest that the clothing industry is responsible for as much as 10% of all global emissions. That's more than all of the international air traffic and shipping combined. It's a huge number of emissions from the world clothing industry. It also creates 20% of the world's wastewater. And this new UN report says we buy 60% more clothing items than we did 15 years ago. and we keep them for half as long. It's this trend of fast fashion. But for every problem, there is a smart solution. There's a site called ThredUp. It's a fashion resale platform, and it's got a cool calculator that will challenge your thinking on buying clothing. So check it out. ThredUp, it's called, and it'll tell you what your habits are and how much of a negative impact you're having on the environment. Are you one of those people who wears clothes till they fall apart, or with the collar frayed slightly and you go, ooh, I should get another one, and off you go and spend some more money on clothing without the thought, not without a thought of the environmental consequences. Somebody who travels the world extensively, somebody who is looking at the world of technology for us this week, is the Managing Director at Worldwide Works, Arthur Goldstuck, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. This is every techno nerd's Christmas, Easter, Passover, Hanukkah, every single holiday in the world rolled into one. Did you make it there this year, Arthur Goldstuck? Oh, Arthur Goldstuck, I've been on holiday for 3 weeks, Arthur. Sorry, I've forgotten how this thing works. Did you make it to CES this year?
Good evening, Bruce. I didn't make it to CES. I get there every 2 or 3 years, but I covered it very intensively by long distance. These days with the web and the streaming of keynotes and launches, it's almost like one's there, except one doesn't get one's hands on the new product. But it's astonishing by following it remotely how much you can actually cover. Because when you're actually there, it's such a vast display and exhibition area. They used to have it in one convention center. Now they can have 5 convention centers across Las Vegas. And it's almost impossible to get to all the convention centers, let alone cover one of them. So by doing it this way, and this is actually a bit of sour grapes, so. But by doing it this way, I got to cover more than I've ever covered before by attending the actual event. So it gave a fantastic perspective on just how much was there.
And your global footprint is smaller, your carbon footprint is smaller as a result as well. So you've done 2 really good things there, Arthur. Well done. Now, listen, our business is unusual this evening. I mean, as kids, you grew up reading, I'm sure, Look and Learn magazine and World of Wonder and similar magazines where there were images regularly on the covers of these magazines of flying cars, and it seemed like a pipe dream. But essentially what we are seeing now with the sort of drone technology that's being developed, the idea of the flying car, the personal air vehicle, or whatever you might do, is looking increasingly likely, and it's being driven by the likes of the Ubers of the world, isn't it?
That's correct. And in fact, you really hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the World of Wonder, because I remember looking at these visions of the future and dreaming that it could be. And at this year's Consumer Electronics Show especially, it felt like a lot of those visions are finally coming true. Because what we had in the past, when they unveiled what they call the concept vehicle in the past, it was always to show what was possible rather than what was probable or what was coming. This time round, they were launching these or displaying these concept vehicles, but as ones that are about to hit us in the real world. And the best example was the vehicle you're talking about, the personal air vehicle from Hyundai. And Hyundai partnered with Uber, which has created a division called Uber Elevate, and they have targeted 2023 as the year they will literally integratively launch their flying taxi service, probably starting in Dubai, but no doubt going to test it in various other areas as well. But the incredible thing about the PAV is that it looks like a drone marrying an aircraft, and it can take off vertically, carry 4 passengers at this stage. It's electronic. It will have a pilot initially, but eventually they expect it to be completely autonomous. And it's got a range on one charge of 100 kilometers. So this is really...
It's incredible, isn't it, considering that not too many electric cars are getting 100 kilometers in range. I mean, the fact that this flying vehicle is able to get a range of 100 Ks or so is not bad going.
For sure. They still have to prove that they can do that, of course, because they haven't tested this vehicle yet. But if they can do it, and they also promising speeds of 290 kilometers an hour, 600 meters above the ground, that is really incredible technology, and it shows how far the vehicle and drone technology has come that they can actually do this. We've seen very large drones doing similar kinds of things, but it's certainly feasible. but we haven't yet seen passengers being carried in this way.
Samsung, are they the world leaders in television technology and television improvements? I mean, every year it's either LG or it's Samsung, and they come out with bigger, flatter, more bendy, more wobbly, more curvy, more whatever it is, TVs. I just don't know how much better TV can get, quite frankly, and how much bigger the blooming screens can get, because they're getting more and more vast and the clarity is getting better and better. But there is always something new on the TV and the TV front at CES, isn't there?
Definitely. I've always seen the biggest tech battle at CES as being the TV wars. In fact, I coverage for the Sunday Times and Business Times, and every single year this time of year I have a feature on the TV wars at CES, because that's where we see the next generation of TV. It's 3 or 4 years down the line is what you and I will be able to afford in local stores. But initially, when they launch these new units, they tend to be at the price of anywhere between $50,000 and $150,000, and it looks impossible for us. It looks far too inaccessible. But then you suddenly look at what was being displayed just 4 years ago, and you see that it's in our stores. It's in the discount stores even. And you're seeing equivalent, not quite the high end that they display at CES, but equivalent TVs from the budget brand, you see them for under 10,000 Rand. So that's how fast the technology arrives in our living rooms, even though it seems like they are displaying it for the elite. In fact, what they're really telling us is what's coming a few years down the line. And Samsung and LG are the dominant players there, and both of them tend to jockey for position as the technology leaders.
My problem here, Arthur, is I'm too much of a cheapskate to buy this year's tech, because the tech is going to be 10 times better and half the price in 5 years' time. So I wait for 5 years. And by the time we get to 5 years, my 15-year-old TV set is still working fine. So I'm going to wait for another 5 years for it to get twice as good and to halve in price once again. I mean, at some point, I suppose I'm going to have to buy something new. But it just feels perpetually like you've got to delay the decision, because it just gets so much better and so much cheaper all the time.
That is a massive challenge facing the TV makers, and that's partly why they keep launching these dazzling new devices. They're trying to tell us all that we're behind the times, that our TVs are obsolete, that what we're experiencing is obsolete. The big thrust of the last 2 or 3 years, aside from the display technology itself, which all the manufacturers are claiming one or other advantage of, is TVs that look like furniture, but not just your traditional furniture. They actually heighten the appearance, the ambience, the aesthetics of your lounge or your living area. And that's been a big emphasis of both LG and Samsung for the last few years. And this year, especially, LG showed a roll-down TV where it actually rolls down from the ceiling. The unit is fixed to the ceiling, and it's a very thin screen that then rolls down. Last year, they had the roll-up TV, where it actually rolled down into the base, and the base became a piece of furniture you could sit on. Samsung's answer this year was something called the Cero, which is actually my pick of the best TV of CES for this year. And that's a TV display that rotates from the normal landscape position that all our TVs in to a vertical position. Why? Because more and more content these days is being produced in a vertical format. So if you, a young person who typically is filming vertically for things like Snapchat and TikTok, you want to view that on a vertical screen, and that's exactly what the Cero is delivering.
And then, I mean, the idea that technology can help humans be better is a thing that I think that drives technology. It makes us all believe that the future can only get better and better and better. And there's a new full-body exoskeleton that enables human beings to do endurance work at a rate that's never before been considered possible.
I love this. This is, in fact, one of my top picks of the year for this year. Certainly one of my top picks. But if I could choose the top three, it could also be in that top three. It's called the Sarcos Guardian XO. It's a company called Sarcos, and they're working with, of all people, Delta Airlines, who've realized that workers are getting injured when they have to lift heavy suitcases, for example. So when Jeremy Maggs travels to CES and someone has to move his bag onto the conveyor belt. They need a bit of extra help there. And the Guardian XO is actually what they call an exoskeleton. But I love the description that they have of it. It's a robot that you can wear. So it looks like a robot. It looks like a big, gangly, Terminator-style robot, but you actually climb into it, and it then increases your strength something like 200 fold, and you can easily lift heavy objects like your bags and suitcases without breaking a sweat and without any risk of injury. So Delta and Cellcross are testing this at the moment, but you can obviously see that the applications are pretty broad in construction in particular, and also in security and for military, I'm sure. A lot of people were surprised that it wasn't the military testing it was part of. But you can see the commercial applications are quite vast. But there's one other aspect of it that's very exciting, and this is a big feature of CES, and that's for people who've got impaired mobility, people who are paralyzed and the like, being suddenly mobile again. We saw tremendous amount of technology at CES, particularly robot technology, aimed at facilitating the lives of people who have got mobility issues.
And then let's one final one. We got the Impossible Burger last year. Could it do the same for bacon?
This is one of the great launches. It's called Impossible Pork, but because the word pork has got such a resonance, apparently the most popular meat in the world. That's what got all the attention. But they also launched something called Impossible Sausage, and both taste like the real thing. Almost everyone who tested it actually says that. They couldn't really tell the difference. In fact, the pork to them tasted richer than regular pork. But they said 25,000 samples, which you can't do with a regular gadget. So you can imagine this menu item replaced gadgetry as one of the sensations of CES. The big thing about the technology of Impossible Pork is that it's entirely vegan, and the company Impossible Foods has isolated a molecule called heme, H-E-M-E, that is what gives meat its distinct flavor when you cook it. And they've found a way to mass produce heme and to put it into these plant-based products to make them taste like meat. And it really is taking over the world of meat consumption.
I mean, especially in places like Asia, where you know, the Asian, the flus that go through the swine herds, for example, there was a massive drop-off in pig populations last year because of fears of disease and all of that sort of stuff. The future is amazing, and the future is incredible, and the future is played out at CES every year. Arthur Goldsack covering that story, MD at Worldwide Works, and really living his brand, and based on the fact that when you consider that you know, technology is meant to make the world smaller. He was able to cover a lot more of CES this year from the comfort of his desk and his computer than ever before, despite going there every 2 or 3 years. I hope that doesn't mean he won't ever be going again, because there's something about holding the technology and feeling the technology. There's also the med wand, and I've heard about these things, a handheld medical diagnostic device, product that is helping get medical diagnoses working far, far better as well. So lots of really huge and interesting stuff. But Impossible Pork, you didn't think it was possible. They've just made it possible. Personal air vehicles, Samsung TVs, bigger and better and more flexible than ever before, and exoskeletons for humans to make it possible for them to do even harder work. Wendy Nolan, she works hard. She's on the line to us from KZN, our consumer ninja, on a Wednesday night. It is Wednesday. Wendy Nola joins us. The National Credit Regulator has said to ShopRite that it's been a very, very naughty retailer when it comes to reckless lending, Wendy Nola. What's the backstory to ShopRite's crime? Sins?
So, well, the National Credit Regulator has been saying it for some time, since they did an investigation in 2014 or 15, I think it was. It went to the National Consumer Tribunal in September of 2017, and they found that ShopRite had failed to conduct proper affordability assessments before granting credit to consumers. In other words, they'd granted credit recklessly, being guilty of reckless lending. And also, so the tribunal, this was back in September 2017, declared that ShopRite had committed conduct prohibited by the National Credit Act and ordered it to pay R1 million fine and also to appoint a debt counsellor to assist those affected to on a case-by-case basis to see if they could either suspend the repayment or restructure them so as not to be reckless. Okay, so ShopRite, as corporates tend to do, appealed the tribunal's ruling in the Pretoria High Court. And on the 18th of December, so almost a month ago now, when we're all sort of in the silly season, a full bench of three judges of the High Court unanimously dismissed the appeal with costs and confirmed the tribunal's ruling almost entirely. So it was quite damning. The regulator must have got back on their holes this week, and just yesterday issued a press release about this 18th of December ruling, High Court decision. I think ShopRite must have thought that it had escaped the publicity, but here we are. And it's quite damning, Bruce. They adjusted credit bureau information. This was a finding to enable credit to be granted when it shouldn't have been, adjusted or disregarded consumers' pre-existing and future financial commitments to create affordability. And apparently, in dismissing the appeal, the High Court noted that the most astonishing aspect of ShopRite's approach to affordability assessments was the fact that many consumers still had negative affordability figures even after they had carried out their adjustments to the affordability calculations. But nevertheless, they went ahead and granted credit to those consumers. It was between June 2013 and June 2014, and the reason the regulator went in and did some sampling of the agreements was there'd been some reports in the media, the good old media, about reckless lending, and so they did their assessment. And here we are, January 2020, the appeal has been dismissed out of High Court, and that fine must be paid. And ShopRite came back and said that they had readjusted that they had already paid, and that the matter relates to credit agreements from just 9 consumers among thousands.
Here's the problem, so, Wendy.
It's a little bit arrogant.
Here's the problem. The exposés happen and it takes years for the consequences to be felt. Is there no way for the regulator to be more effective, more efficient, to be to act more quickly against these guys?
Well, you should all. I'd love you to ask them that. So they did the investigation, started in September of 2014, landed up at the Consumer Tribunal in September 2017, 3 years later, then was appealed, and now we are, it is rather ridiculous. And ShopRite is saying they changed their whole affordability assessment model in 2015 when there was an amendment to the National Credit Act anyway. So they're sort of going, well, this is ancient history, but it's still very damning that it happened. And clearly, I still get cases all the time where the affordability is massaged in order for someone to be granted credit. It is still happening. For me, one of the most shocking things was when their counsel in court was defending, why they granted in these various cases. In the 3 or 4 of the cases, they said, well, the person was married, so the wife would help. On what basis? Or they could do without DSTV, or they had fat in their bond, Bruce.
It's desperate measures for desperate times for some of these retailers, and I suppose they've got to make some kind of excuse, but the excuses are wearing very thin. Wendy Nola, thank you. Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola, on a story of a retailer that got caught out, and lots of retailers often do get caught out. The problem with this is, though, that you don't have a speedy enough turnaround. You don't get the retribution coming quickly enough. And now they can easily sit back and say, oh, it was just a mistake. It's such a long time ago. Let's look forward. Let's not look back. And we need to be cross about this. Here is a situation where people who should not be getting loans because they get sold down the river. People are desperate for money, and I get that and everything else. But if you can't afford to borrow the money and
afford to pay it back, nobody should be lending you the money in the first place.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters. Well, can you imagine living in a cashless South Africa? It's a dream that many people have got. Personally, I can't ever see it happening. You can't pay a bribe digitally. It's much easier to trace, of course, if you pay a bribe digitally because there's a transaction and money left one place and ended up in another. It's much harder to trace 600,000 rand in a black plastic bag than it is if you actually have to hand over a credit card. I'm not sure that the politically connected would ever tolerate an end to cash on that basis, but we can still dream of an environment where you don't have to draw cash. You don't have to worry about being mugged at the ATM. If you're the CEO of a bank, you don't have to worry about your cash in transit vehicles, or the CEO of a retailer. Or if you are somebody who works in a retail outlet in a particularly vulnerable part of town, nobody's going to come rob you because they can't steal the physical cash. Wouldn't it be nice to have a cashless future? Well, Clayton Hayward is co-founder of Ukeshe. Ukeshe is a new platform. It's been around for a little while now, but essentially what you wanted to do, you're a payments company, Clayton, what you're trying to do here is disrupt the cash economy. You want fewer of us to carry cash.
That's exactly right, Bruce. Thanks for having me. You know, I think that's about 5.6 million small businesses in this country, of which 3.3 million are survivalist entrepreneurs, guys on the side of the road selling things. And they are being excluded from the formal financial services market because the guys with cash driving past in their shiny cars all have cards and don't have cash. So even though they're trying to sell you a cap or a phone charger or something, we can't buy it from them because all of us are now digital.
So you are aiming your cash then at people who don't have bank accounts. I mean, it's a terrible term, but people who are unbanked, people who don't earn enough, people who have posed too high a risk for a bank to let them open an account, or they choose not to open an account because they perceive it to be too expensive.
I think it's generally they perceive it to be too expensive and inaccessible to them. And many of them have had bank accounts and they've ended up in a situation that those accounts became overdrawn due to unscrupulous debit orders. So they end up in a situation that they were effectively banked, but then the banking costs just got too much for them. So they were chased away from the system.
I mean, these are people you might see on the side of the road selling bananas and potatoes. I mean, informal traders, street vendors, people like car guards, for example,
yes.
who would like to get a tip, and there's not always money to give a tip because not everybody carries cash or doesn't have the right sort of denomination of cash to give that tip, but you'd like to give the guy something. And sometimes it's a case of, well, sorry, I just can't help you. And the guy looks at you and goes, yeah, of course, you and your fancy car.
Yeah.
You don't have cash. Of course you don't. But they could flash an Ukeshe ticket in the person's face and get the person to give them a tip that way.
Exactly. You know, so we've made it very simple. No need for a smartphone for these guys. They can just go and pick up a unique Ukeshe card at the nearest Pick and Pay store. And by the time they walk out the store, they can start accepting payments. People can just scan their QR code with any of their favorite banking apps on their phone, and they will be able to receive a payment immediately and then go and withdraw that cash at any Pick and Pay till or even at a Standard Bank ATM.
Okay, I mean, give me a sense of then the mechanism here, because here I am, somebody who doesn't have any kind of formal financial arrangement. I can simply get one of these cards. It's a card that hangs on a lanyard, I assume. It's visible. I direct you out of your parking bay and I say, have a lovely day, Mr. Hayward. Off you go, and you go, oh, let me give him $5, $10, or whatever it is that you want to do. You simply scan my barcode and I then get paid. I don't understand. Where is the money stored? Because in a digital transaction, it moves from one digital account to another digital account. But suddenly, I've got just a barcode.
Yeah.
Where does the money get stored to allow me to retrieve it later?
So technically, how it works is that we have what's called an e-wallet or a mobile wallet sitting at the back end of this merchant's account. So they receive the money into this wallet, and they then have the ability to access that wallet via a USSD menu or via WhatsApp or via our app. And then they can decide what they want to do with that money. So they can either, if they have a bank account, they can EFT the money out. If they don't have a bank account, they can request a voucher and to withdraw the money at a Pick and Pay till. or they could send the money to one of their family members, or they could buy airtime, they could buy electricity, they could pay their DSTV bill. So we're essentially trying to expose them to a broader set of financial services now that they're receiving this this digital money.
Somebody like the best example I can think of this is somebody like Clem Santa, who still listens to the show. He's retired now, but Clem would go to conferences and take out his briefcase with his books, and Clem would sell his books at events and things where he was giving talks. Could somebody like a Clem use Orkesh?
Exactly.
And say, scan my barcode, it's R149.99. It doesn't have to be 5 or 10 bucks. It could be a more sizable amount of money.
Yeah. So our limitations are, you know, from a maximum transaction point of view, we allow a turnover of 25,000 rand a month, which is in terms of the SARB regulations.
Sure.
Because of the limited KYC that we perform on these merchants. So you can do significant turnover using this platform, and should you then want to move to a larger turnover, then we would recommend you to one of the mainstream platforms out there for proper merchant acquiring.
So I couldn't get myself five Orkeshes and operate them back to back or side by side?
No, you couldn't. You know, so that's where what would happen then is the anti-money laundering regulations kick in, and we start managing and go, well, it's the same person, he's got multiple cards, he's trying to do dodgy transactions, and we block that.
Actually, he's stealing cars and selling cars on the streets. And his, for example, because I mean, the criminal mind is ingenious, and people find ways of dodging the formal financial system. And you did run into a bit of a blockage, didn't you, with the Reserve Bank, with the regulators, because local banking legislation is amongst the strictest in the world in terms of deposit-taking institutions. And they looked at you and said, "Hold on a second, but you're not a bank."
Yeah.
And you said, "No, we're not a bank." And they said, "But you're behaving like a bank." And so the regulators got hold of you, did they?
Yeah, well, we've had a bit of a roller coaster ride since we launched, and I think like any young fintech startup, you think you're going to conquer the world, and you think that regulations are put there to slow you down
for other people,
and yeah. They're not relevant to us. They're just trying to stifle our business. But what we learned very quickly is those regulations are there not only to protect ourselves but also to protect the consumer, because fraud in this card space is just huge. And the reason why we have to have regulations in place, like simple KYC, is, you know, otherwise it's just a free-for-all. And we saw that on our platform in the early days when we launched. We had a lot of illegitimate transactions. And since we've worked with the Reserve Bank and worked very closely with our sponsor bank in terms of Nedbank and together with MasterCard, they've worked very closely with us to create an environment now that is fully compliant, and that we are able to onboard the right client and make sure that they're doing things the right way.
I'm talking to Clayton Haywood this evening, the co-founder of Orkesh, and it is a cashless payment system. But it's a cashless payment system for people who don't want to be part of the formal banking system or can't be part of the formal banking system. And it's got a whole range of uses. And if you're running a micro enterprise and you've got turnover of less than 25,000 rand a month, you can transact and you can sell your goods essentially for cash. It's the same thing. By using this particular payment device, a card, a tag around your neck with a QR code, with a barcode that says you've been paid $5, $10, $150, whatever it might be. You can then go and cash that out at a Standard Bank ATM, a Pick and Pay, a Builder's Warehouse, a PEP, all of these different places where it is possible to go and withdraw those funds. But it's not a simple path. You think that this sounds like a terribly good idea and an awfully simple business. But you know what? Nothing is simple. More with Clayton Haywood in just a moment. Because not only did they run into trouble with regulators, but they've also had to go out and do the really important stuff of raising money. And they managed to raise, in dollar terms, seed funding of $500,000. How did they do that on a bright idea? More on that in a moment.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
Clayton Haywood, co-founder of Orkesh, is in studio with us this evening. We're talking about a new payment system that is aimed at people who don't have access to the formal banking system. You got $500,000 in seed funding when the company was just 10 months old. There's got to be a good story here. Who did you know?
You know what? My co-founders and I have been in the business for a good 20 years. So it's not our first.
When you say the business, you mean the payments industry broadly?
The tech business. So tech technology startups, ranging from ERP systems to telco platforms to payments platforms to loyalty platforms. So we've done a lot of projects over the last 25 years, and in that we've built a big network, and we've also built a reputation in terms of delivering real value. And I think when raising money, I think a lot of entrepreneurs think that they can write a very fancy PowerPoint presentation and get investors to part with money. We only went to go and raise money after we had spent most probably 10 million rand of our own money, and we had acquired 250,000 clients. So we not only spent our own money, we went out there and proved the business model before we went and asked other people to say, do you believe in the business?
I mean, and for so many people who want to get involved in business themselves, they think, well, I can't get capital. I've got this great idea. I'm going to start up a platform and I'm going to call it Ukesh and I'm going to get 250,000 clients and it's going to be fabulous. But they have no money of their own. They've got no connections. They've got no networks. And it just stresses time and time again that an overnight success usually takes between 10 and 20 years to achieve.
Yeah, it's very hard. And especially in this financial services fintech space. Because as you mentioned earlier, the regulatory hurdles are just huge. Just tying up a relationship with a bank and a relationship with a card processor and a relationship with a retail partner doesn't happen overnight. So you could end up spending all your money before you've even formalized your business relationships.
Yeah, critical. So where does $500,000 come from then?
Well, we raised it locally. So we had existing investment partners, a company called Ocean 76 and another company called FiTech Ventures that both invested in us. And they invested on us based on previous projects that we had worked on with them. So we had an existing relationship with them that made the due diligence process obviously a lot easier for them to make the commitment to invest in the business.
Okay. So, I mean, this is serious stuff. I mean, did you raise that money? It's dollars. So I'm assuming you went internationally to raise that money. Take me through the process.
The process generally is put together your financial model, your forecast for the next year, how you're going to do it, how you're going to grow it, and most importantly, where you're going to spend the money. Investors want to know what you're going to spend their money on. And the big thing that frightens them away is when they open your presentation deck and there's this big payroll that says that the CTO and the CEO and the CFO and the CMO are all going to take these very big salaries and we're going to spend 50 Rand on marketing. Where what they want to see is they want to say, oh, you're going to take $500,000 and you're going to spend it on customer acquisition. And that's what they want to see.
And I mean, clearly you managed to convince them because they gave you the money when you were just 10 months old. And you've been going for how long?
We launched in November. So we're 14 months old now.
Okay. So just 14 months old. You had 250,000 customers, but when the Reserve Bank clamped down on you, did you have to shed some of those customers? Have you sort of almost gone back to square one a bit?
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. So we didn't have to shed them all, but essentially we had to make them compliant. So what we had to do is we had to limit their functionality to say that if you want to continue using the platform, you need to go through the KYC process and submit your identification documentation. And we've slowly been onboarding the existing base and new customers since, call it October last year, and we're at a rate of 10 to 20,000 a month now.
That's pretty good going. Yeah. I mean, has it changed the sort of business model in terms of the sort of costs that you have to incur? Because it suddenly becomes a lot more expensive and sort of energy intensive business than it was perhaps before.
Yeah, we didn't have a compliance department before. Now we do. So compliance costs money. So I think in your interview with Stephen Confancola earlier, you mentioned it. So compliance is a big element in this financial services space, so we've had to put a lot more attention into compliance and our systems and how we manage it. So our acquisition cost has obviously gone up to acquire clients. Having said that, the quality of clients that we are acquiring are now better. So the people that are going to the effort to register and come on board really want to use the platform. They're not people wanting to game the platform or people trying to use it to launder money.
How do you make your money? How do you get paid? Because you've got these complex relationships. You're in a business partnership with Nedbank. You've got MasterCard on board. None of these guys do anything as nice as they are. for nothing.
Yeah. So payments is an interesting one, because my view is payments is a race to zero. So payments ultimately will be free. So we definitely can't build a strategy around making money out of payments. Our view is that we want to acquire a very large customer base, and we will then provide broader financial services in the form of lending and insurance to certain people in that group of clients that we have. So based on their revenues and based on their behavior, we can build our own credit profile on them, which no other lender in the market has the ability to do. Because essentially, we're now banking these unbanked people. So we know how much they're earning. We know what they're doing with their money. So we can now say to them, okay, we'll give you a small loan to help grow your business. And that's where we see ourselves making money in the longer term, in terms of, and then providing them insurance. So health, life, insurance benefits that previously, again, they wouldn't have had access to. And we can now provide them with those because we are fully licensed FSP.
So essentially, this is a sort of an introduction into microlending. I mean, this is a way of creating a customer base that then treats you like a traditional financial services provider. So you go from being the anti-financial services provider to being mainstream at some point.
Correct.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a criticism.
It's no, 100%.
It's an observation.
No, it's 100%.
It's an observation. Observation. The trouble with these fintech startups also is you're hardly creating any jobs. It feels like, you know, when you've got these tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of customers that you're going to need to employ thousands and thousands of people, but the tech is so blooming good that you can actually operate in a very lean and mean way. And
yep.
You're able, therefore, to be massively efficient.
Yeah, but the jobs that we are creating is we're creating what we call Ukesh ambassadors in the communities, and they're people that go out and onboard merchants, teach them about the platform, help them with their technical issues. They can also help them sell new products in terms of airtime, electricity, data. So we're creating those jobs in the communities for people to become the brand ambassadors for Ukesh in their township or in their community or in their village.
How big can you get? I mean, is that an odd question? What's the business plan suggest you will be in a year and 5 years from now?
Well, as I mentioned right at the beginning, there's 5.6 million what we call micro businesses in South Africa. So if you take that's the target market, and each of those micro businesses must probably then has a relationship with a few family members that they then going to onboard onto the platform as well. So I believe that over the next 2-3 years, we could get to the 10 million member number and then scale into other markets. And we're already looking at scaling into those other markets with our partners, specifically MasterCard, because, you know, financial inclusion is not a problem that's unique to South Africa. We've just come back from Singapore, and in Southeast Asia, cash still dominates 70% of all transactions, far more than actually even Africa.
Yeah, and the point is, I mean, the more cashless we can become, the more traceable money becomes. The more
Exactly.
traceable money is, the more people can be brought into the formal economy, and the less money kind of just sort of disappears into the sand.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, our holy grail challenge, if we want to call it that, is to try and get the taxi industry to adopt Ukesh so that we can get those transactions happening between passengers and drivers totally cashless.
And it would make a hell of a difference. You don't have to be sitting back in the taxi and passing forward your money and waiting for the change to come back, and suddenly the guy who's got the change jumps off the taxi at the next stop and disappears. That sort of stuff is then avoided. Clayton Hayward, thank you for coming in and telling us the story of Ukesh. It is the story of a South African startup, 14 months old, raised $500,000. But the guys who have started this business have been in the technology sector for the last 20-odd years or so. They've built up their networks. They've understood that an overnight success takes decades.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
That's it from this evening's edition of The Money Show. Hopefully next time we speak, money's cheaper. But that is unlikely. We live in hope, though. Till then, good night.